Welcome to The Yak. I'm Mary Louise O'Callaghan. Our world is racked by tragedy, suffering and despair. It can easily become all a bit of a blur, especially when the conflict and violence has persisted for decades with seemingly no end in sight. In this episode, we'll hear from former child soldiers who are caught up in one of the world's most tragic but largely forgotten humanitarian emergencies. Buried deep in the heart of Africa, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or the DRC as it's known, has been in the grip of one of the longest and yet underreported crises in the world. Here's Brianna Piazza from World Vision Australia's media team, who recently travelled to the DRC with Sydney Morning Herald journalist David Rowe and photographer Kate Garrity.
Children in a small town in Kasai in central DR Congo are celebrating. It's probably the last place you'd expect to hear children singing, laughing, and having fun with their friends. Almost every child here has either lost a loved one to violence or illness, or they have been pulled into battle as a soldier. Wilson, who is 15 years old, is one of them. We've changed his name to protect his identity. Wilson was at home when a militia group attacked his village in Kasai Central. They attacked the unsuspecting families with guns and machetes.
They killed our brothers. They burned our houses. They killed our goats and our pigs. They destroyed everything and left us with nowhere to sleep. That's why we got angry and joined the militia. In battle, I used a long knife.
Did you use your weapon against anyone?
Yes.
To kill?
Yes.
Wilson killed 5 soldiers. How did you feel after the first time you killed a soldier?
It made me feel very powerful.
The soldiers' bullets couldn't penetrate us because of our powers. That's how we could get close to them.
The powers Wilson refers to are the magic powers he says he gained at a ceremony. He and his friends were taught to take the bodies of the men they killed and crush the skulls into powder. They'd pour it into wine and drink the soldiers' blood. They believe this ritual creates a magic potion to repel bullets and protect them in battle. Children who survived the conflict say the magic made them powerful. But as for their friends who died, it's generally accepted the magic didn't protect them because they either didn't believe in the magic or they didn't perform the ritual correctly.
This is David Rowe, the national security correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and Age newspapers. I went with Kate Garrity, our photographer, and World Vision Australia to the DRC around the middle of last year to report on the war in Kasai region, which is a part of the southern area of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Kate and I really wanted to go to the DRC because it consistently ranks as the most neglected crisis in the world. Obviously, as a journalist, you always want to go to the most important places and cover the most important issues that nobody else is talking about. The phenomenon of child soldiers is a really fascinating one to examine as a journalist. They're very easy targets to recruit because the social fabric is very poor. There are very few opportunities, very little money. You can see that parents are just struggling to get by. This is assuming that both of the parents are still alive. In a lot of cases, you know, one of the parents is gone or has died. Often it's just mothers looking after the kids. And all the parents can do is just find a way to scrape enough money and food together to keep everybody fed. So it's pretty hard to be a parent and pretty easy as a child to get drawn into the wrong ideas and get pulled down the wrong path. So when a civil war kicks off, I mean, it was a rebellion really as a start. When something like that starts spreading, there's probably some excitement. As a kid, you've got nothing else to do. somebody comes along and offers you money and excitement. You get told that you're going to be a soldier in a future government. I mean, that's what kids were being told. And particularly the money, I mean, you say yes. And pretty soon you figure out you've been duped because you get given a stick, not even a gun, and you just get thrown into the thick of it.
It's a war crime to recruit and use children in armed conflict. However, in Kasai, children were recruited in the thousands. They made up an estimated 60% of militia fighters. In August 2016, ongoing tensions between the Kamuin and Asapu group and the DRC government came to a head, sparking a rebellion. Violence spread, but it wasn't long before different people took up arms for different reasons. Children were caught in the crossfire. Some others reported revenge attacks because of long-standing tensions between different communities. Ethnic minorities said they were being persecuted. Others say it was to teach them a lesson because they wouldn't join the rebellion. Then there are village leaders who say they don't even know why their people were attacked. John Okwiti is a child protection worker in Kasai. He has been trying to help children deal with their violent past.
There are many stories that can be told about the crisis in Kasai and the war that was happening. Most of the people who were going to the battlefield were children. Why? Before the war, initiation sessions were organized. Children were given magic potions to protect them. Because according to black magic, mystic rituals were performed and magic potions of invulnerability were given to children as an incentive to recruit them for the front lines. It was well known that children can remember and carry out orders well. When you say something to a child, he listens carefully. He remembers without questioning them. That's why there were more children in the battlefields. And even if you ask various sources, they would always tell you that every child in some of the villages in Dibaya was enrolled in the militias, whether consciously or unconsciously, because either the parents were leaving and gave the potion to the children, or it was the child who themselves with friends who would drink the potion.
Many children have learned that they are capable of killing and that it's honourable to spill blood. David Rowe again.
The kids were blinded, I think, to what they were doing. Alcohol was part of the ritual. The whole thing is sort of culturally enabled by these myths that are very, very powerful in the society in Kasai. They go through these, what they call baptisms, where they, well, I mean, they drink alcohol, but initially it's like a religious ritual in lots of countries, I suppose. The food in some cases was actually human flesh and human bones ground down after being burned in fires. I mean, that was a story that we heard firsthand from at least one of the child soldiers that we spoke to. And they believe that this gives them magical powers. It makes them invincible. And everyone believes it. And if you add alcohol, potentially drugs, onto that as well, it's easy to understand how kids don't know what they're doing. The first village I remember stopping at, pretty soon these stories just started pouring out one after the other after the other. The soldiers had come to the village and just started shooting randomly. From memory, maybe 15 or 16 of the villagers died. We met a couple of brothers. Their mother had been shot dead in front of them while they were running away from the village. These boys didn't go on to become child soldiers, but I thought afterwards, how do you restrain yourself after going through something like that? How do you stop becoming so enraged that you just want to pick something up and fight back? At least 3,000 people were killed in the period around 2016. It's probably much more than that. It's just that nobody was able to reliably count the number of dead, but you really got the feeling that kids were being used as cannon fodder. They were just kind of sent in, and soldiers would shoot and shoot and shoot until they ran out of bullets, and then the kids would charge them with sticks and machetes if they had them, maybe gardening tools. It's really horrible stuff to think about, but we just heard these stories over and over and over.
Victor decided to join an armed group when the violence broke out. He was 15 years old.
When I saw my friends fighting in the militia, I felt compelled in my heart to join too. So I signed up, my name was added to their list, and I was baptized as a militia member. They gave us alcoholic potions and they slapped us all over the body with leopard skins. After some time sitting around the holy campfire, I gathered the courage to fight. When I was ready, they told me I could go. They gave me a machete. I started fighting against the soldiers. I closed in on one. He was shooting at me, but the bullets could not touch me. I knocked the soldier to the ground and I cut off his head. I brought the head to the holy campfire. When I brought the head to the camp, my commander thanked me. He said I had caught someone who was very strong. The head dried out and the commander asked me to crush it finally into powder. So I gave them the powder. They put it into wine. Then they gave it to us to drink so that we could become fierce and we could fight without fear.
A lot of the children who were involved in the militias aren't in school, and they're still not in school. About 400 schools in Kasai were damaged or destroyed. John Okwite says education is the missing link that could help them. Yet not even 11% of the USD $120 million required for education under the DRC's Humanitarian Response Plan for 2018 was funded, according to the International Financial Tracking Service.
The right to go to school for a child is an essential right. And this right is necessary for every child, regardless of whether they are boys or girls. If a child can go to school, it can lay the foundation for the next crisis. So if every child could have access to education, as other children elsewhere, it would be a way for teachers to prevent the expansion of the crisis, the war in our neighborhood. If the war has been spreading, it is because of the lack of access to education for some of them. A child who has grown up without education could accept anything. The one with education can distinguish what is good and what is not, what to believe and what not to believe. And in that sense, we can think of it having contributed to saving an entire generation from fighting. In fact, I could speak about so many important matters, but some are extremely important, such as working to reunite families. Really, we need to work hard on this. Apart from this, we need also to do a lot to support former child soldiers in the militias. This work involves raising awareness, and then we need to intervene in terms of building resilience and capacity through working with the training centers. Why? Because at that time, there were some people and some children who were militias. The crisis has been going since 2015. As the crisis worsened, the children kept growing up. But now after the crisis, those children have reached 18 years old. So they are not children anymore. As you can see, this is really complex. Because the children were younger during the crisis, and then after the crisis, they are not children anymore, but they still need to be taken care of and supported. Therefore, we need to acknowledge this transition phase. We need to take into account this transition from childhood to adulthood. Is it right that they are excluded from accessing and getting support because they have since become adults? I will let you judge for yourself.
The lack of education and the violence aren't the only things plaguing the country right now. Sydney Morning Herald photographer, Kate Geraghty, is at the Moyo Health Centre in Kasai. She's photographing parents bringing their malnourished children here. Farmers are now returning to their land after fleeing their villages during the wave of violence. Homes and fields were burnt, and many crop harvest seasons were lost. It contributed to a 750% spike in food insecurity. This is in a country that's already responsible for 12% of the world's malnutrition cases. Dr. Norbert Kapenda works at the Moyo Health Centre in Shimbulu Village. The health centre is struggling to keep up with cases.
After the crisis, when there was some free treatment, we recorded a lot of cases of people who were sick and recorded many cases of diseases. First of all, over here is malaria, malnutrition, diarrhea also. There are also issues with lung, respiratory infections. We can add hygienic diseases more broadly. This child here is receiving medical treatment, but you can see he does not have nutritional assistance, despite the advice that was given to the child and his family. So there is no taking care of. This is a problem for those children who are there.
At the heart of the issue, he says, is poverty and the lack of money. The average cost of taking care of a sick child at the centre is about 3,500 Congolese francs, which is $3 Australian. Yet families still can't afford the treatment their children desperately need. Dr. Norbert Kapenda says the centre has gone into debt by treating patients who can't repay the costs.
But this is a real issue for the population. They don't have money. This is really complex. Since 2016, there have been people who've fled from this area, and there are people who have come here from other places. But there is no work, no jobs, so life's become really difficult. And to get supplies, you have to leave Chimulu and travel to 70, 80 kilometres away to buy corn and then come back here. And at the moment, if you go to the market, the price of corn's increased. We've received support from the World Food Programme, which has provided food. It's helped a bit for people here and around Chibulu. But right now, it's really difficult.
One of the greatest problems aid agencies face is that malnutrition and hunger are among the most crucial needs requiring urgent treatment. But the issue rarely makes global headlines unless there's a famine on a much larger scale. More than 13 million people in the DRC require humanitarian assistance. The situation is on par with the Syria crisis in terms of the scale. And yet, the DRC receives nowhere near the amount of political, media or donor attention that Syria does. Last year, donors gave twice as much funding to the Syria Humanitarian Response Plan as they did to the DRC. Why is it that some emergency responses capture the hearts of millions of Australians so they give generously, while others don't? Is it simply the fact that people don't know enough about the situation? Or that it's too far removed from our sense of normalcy? Is it subtle racism or ignorance? Why is it that aid agencies like World Vision Australia generally find donors are often more willing to give money to the Rohingya and Syria crises, but not for Central and East Africa? David Rowe shares his thoughts.
We knew that sexual violence was a huge issue. We knew that the recruitment of child soldiers was a huge issue. Government neglect, poverty. We knew all of that. I wondered what the emotional experience would be like. I found after a while it was mostly a kind of anger that in a country that has so much potential, you just drive through village after village where people are enduring life and not much more than that. And you see these children playing in these villages where there's just dirt and dust and houses made from not much at all. And you drive through them and there's just one after another, after another, after another. all these children in a country that has so much going for it, and yet because of politics and war and neglect, people end up living in these circumstances. I guess I just really hope that the DRC gets a lot more attention in Western countries, in developed and wealthy countries, countries that can afford to do something about it. It gets ignored. It's easy to ignore because it's not producing any of the kind of global problems that other parts of the world produce. We put all this attention on the Middle East because it's produced terrorist organizations that we worry about day and night. We worry about, you know, other parts of the world, maybe South America or Central America, because it produces narcotics that we're worried about our children taking. But a place like DRC, its problems don't really affect us.
But as for why people should care about what's happening in the DRC, the country has immense mineral wealth, which has been the source of exploitation for many years. You may have heard of blood diamonds, where militias would force people into slave labour. Many people would die under brutal conditions for the sake of militias making a profit by exporting diamonds to the rest of the world. They then use the money to buy weapons and support their cause. A lot of mines in countries like the DRC still employ children. It's hard labour, but children in Kasai choose to work in this mine to support their families instead of going to school. Children as young as 8 help their older brothers, who dig up the ground, by carrying 10 to 20 kilograms of soil in a bag over their shoulders down a steep, rocky cliff. They deliver it to older men in a river who use water in a pan to sort diamonds from soil. The children say they earn only a few cents for every bag they carry. The workers admit they don't make as much money from diamonds as they used to, but there are other minerals in the DRC that are high in demand. This includes coltan, used in everything from tech gadgets to jet engines and even hospital equipment to treat cancer. World Vision Australia's senior advocacy campaigns lead, Adam Valvasori, has launched a campaign about the issue.
Like blood diamonds before it, coltan is becoming a natural resource that people are becoming more aware of, has a dark shadow over it. We know that it employs a lot of child labour, especially in the DRC. And as consumers, that's something that we can do that's quite easy, just to ask the question, where's the coltan that's in my mobile phone or iPad or computer? Where's that from? Is the company I'm going to buy my next one from sourced responsibly and ethically? World Vision is running a spotlight on the DRC because it's one of the most forgotten crises in the world. Australia really needs to step up, and that's where World Vision's advocacy comes in. We're hoping to educate our supporters and equip them with the tools to contact their local MP and ask them to make it a priority for Australian Aid this year. So people can go to our website, worldvision.com.au/DRC, and write an email to your MP about the forgotten crisis in the DRC.
Moving to the east of the country, in the North Kivu area, which borders Uganda, the latest fight on aid agencies' hands is the deadly Ebola virus.
There's been a fresh Ebola outbreak in Central Africa, and 9 neighbouring countries have been put on alert.
The latest Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, has entered a new phase.
The latest outbreak poses various challenges for the WHO. There are fears over security, since the region has been embroiled in decades of conflict.
On top of that, the city is also a major transport hub. If the Ebola spreads to the capital, it will be way more difficult to control, and the outbreak could be far more serious.
The militia violence in this part of the country makes it a particularly challenging context for attempts to vaccinate people and respond to the outbreak. It's the DRC's worst Ebola outbreak in history, with several hundred people killed, and UN agencies warn it could get worse. World Vision is responding by training community health workers and offering sanitation programs to help limit the spread. But with the crisis set to continue beyond the anticipated timeframe, many aid actors are facing funding gaps. Right now, World Vision is responding across the world. Every emergency is challenging, but some are more forgotten than others. The reality is, it's not just the Democratic Republic of the Congo that's forgotten. There are humanitarian responses across the world, from Ukraine, Libya, Central African Republic, and Haiti, that aren't even half funded, according to the International Financial Tracking Service. For many people who witnessed violence firsthand in Kasai, the pain from the past lingers. To this day, Chief Kamuandu's village is literally still surrounded by the bones of his neighbours.
People's bones are in the bushes. Another body was left in the toilet. Fighters were killing people randomly as they ran. The first group of fighters were treating people terribly, raping women and girls and looting. As chief of the village, I tell my people that what's happened is in the past. And we pray to God that the future will bring peace and the election brings us good leaders. We're praying that this never happens again. We are praying for peaceful rulers.
That's Chief Kamuandu ending the story. Thanks to Kate Garrity from the Sydney Morning Herald, who collected much of the audio you heard. If you'd like to find out more about the situation in Kasai, read David Rowe's feature online, Magic, Murder and the Lost Boys of Congo's Long War. You can also donate to our DRC response by visiting worldvision.com.au, where you can find out more about the work we're doing, including the psychosocial support we're providing to former child soldiers and the support we're giving to families in the DRC to enhance their nutrition, education and shelter. Thanks for listening up to The Yak.